This is Eco Radio KC, a locally produced exploration of positive solutions to the ecological challenges we face as we work to create a healthier future for our community and the planet.
Good evening and welcome to Eco Radio KC. On tonight's program, host Craig Lubo welcomes Bob Groves, the Sierra Club Missouri chapter's legislative chair. We'll also close out as usual with This Week in Water, but first I'm Mike Murphy with some environmental headlines. EcoWatch is reporting that Denver has become the 73rd city in the U.S. to commit to 100% renewable energy when Mayor Michael Hancock announced the goal in his State of the City speech on Monday. That's last Monday. This is according to the Denver Post. The commitment is part of the city's larger 80 by 50 climate action plan unveiled by Hancock on Tuesday, which seeks to reduce Denver's greenhouse gas emissions 80% from 2005 levels by the year 2050. Democracy Now! Is reporting that the Trump administration is seeking to roll back the Endangered Species Act. The Trump administration on Thursday announced plans to roll back the act, ordering federal agencies to consider economic impacts before listing animals as protected under the law. The newly proposed guidelines by the Interior Department would allow corporations involved in mining, drilling, or other forms of extraction to proceed with projects that otherwise would be prohibited. In response, the Natural Resources Defense Council tweeted, "This is unacceptable. The ESA is a wildly successful piece of legislation that has prevented 99% of the species it protects from going extinct." And Democracy Now! Is also reporting aides to former EPA Administrator Scott Pruitt held a newly purchased office desk in storage to air out for days after raising concerns that it contained formaldehyde. That's according to Politico, which obtained an email showing staffers sought to shield Pruitt from the toxic chemical after he purchased the desk as part of a $9,500 redecoration of his office. Politico reports that just months later, the same aides blocked the release of a report on the health dangers of formaldehyde. And that's all the news we have for this evening. And now here's your host, Craig Lubo.
Okay, thank you, Mike. This is Craig, and I am here. I actually have two guests tonight. We have Bob Groves, who is the legislative director for the Thomas Hart Benton Group of the Sierra Club and for the chapter, Missouri chapter.
Hi, Craig.
Welcome, Bob. And my other guest is retired Brigadier General Chris King. He has a PhD in environmental engineering, and he will talk about national security implications of climate change. Welcome, Chris.
Thanks, Craig. Glad to be here.
Okay. Bob, let's talk about what are the current actions that Missouri chapter is working on.
Missouri's been very busy this year besides our lobby activities in Jefferson City. Earlier this year, we're currently working on an event August 7th, which is primary election night, as most of us know. So we're rolling that event into a combined presentation on climate change with an election watch party. And as a large event, we're also hosting our annual silent auction as part of that. And we've invited General King to come in and speak as at that meeting, which, you know, is why the general's here. So a lot of really incredible information at the global level and a lot of local initiative to help raise fund and help us pursue our environmental actions.
And what are the three core campaigns that Missouri chapter is working on?
Right now there's the Ready KC campaign, which is tied in with our Ready for 100 and Mayors for 100, basically the renewable energy processes. We've been meeting with the Kansas City people about their 10 initiatives, clean energy, and we're very pleased and enthused by the steps that they're taking to bring renewable energy to the cities. We're very excited about Independence's expansion of their second phase solar community farm, making them possibly one of the largest solar producers in Missouri. And we've also been working with the Airport Commission to look at eco options, you know, how to rebuild the KCI Airport to make it a leading ecological structure moving into the future.
And what kind of feedback or support are you getting from the Airport Authority to design green building into it?
The feedback's been very positive. Councilwoman Jolie Justice and some other people actually came and spoke at our meeting in February. So they were describing the process to us, and they actually reached out to us and asked us to, you know, offer them advice on how to move forward and be ecological. So that actually led to a Thomas Hart Benton process where we put out an open question to our membership, asking them to submit recommendations. And then we went through a ranking process to take those survey results and rank them by importance, generating what we call the Go Eco KCI report, which we presented to Kansas City, I think 3 weeks ago. It was earlier this month. Jolie Justice and the Director of Aviation both sitting there receiving the report. Very positive on our report. They were very enthusiastic about it. I believe they immediately took it into a design meeting with the engineering firms and discussed that. So we will be following up with that later this fall.
Okay. And what is Missouri doing to encourage renewables? And is there legislation that Sierra Club is trying to get Missouri to pass?
Well, it's interesting because the Sierra Club was successful in St. Louis earlier this year, getting their resolution to reach 100% renewable. Well, I shouldn't say that number. I don't remember the specifics. But, you know, they made a commitment to reach a certain standard percentage of renewable energy by a given deadline. So that's actually a resolution by City Council, and they're going to follow up on that. We are in a position where we're encouraging Kansas City to adopt similar resolutions. Their recent study on the feasibility of clean energy indicates they're very supportive of that. I mean, they are already looking into the possibilities before we reached out to them. And we also had some discussions with KCPL. So you may know that Kansas City Power and Light has already reached out to the PSC to get permission to create a green tariff that would be available to Kansas City and, you know, other direct contractors with them, and also to install some community solar farms here within the metro area. And at that city council meeting where that was shared, one of the council members actually raised their hand and said, you know, if that's approved, we're ready to sign a 20-year contract for 100% renewable. So, I mean, this is in place. This is going to move. I believe the PSC hearings for the KCP&L requests should be later this fall, perhaps November. I know that some of the other utilities in Missouri had similar requests that went through the PSC earlier this year, and they were approved. So we're incredibly optimistic that the same process will happen with KCP&L, and, you know, by the end of the year, early next year, we'll see our cities getting all their electricity from renewable resources.
And in Independence, they have a solar farm. What can you tell us about that?
I don't know a lot of details about that. They've had a phase one solar farm for quite a while. They had that coal power plant that they had shut down previously, and on those grounds they had put solar. Now they just recently put out a request for bid for a second phase. And I believe that that's been a couple of weeks ago. I believe that there were maybe three aspects to that. They wanted bids on expanding solar on their facility. They wanted additional bids on expanding solar on other facilities. And they were also looking for bids on partnering with other organizations to kind of share community solar. So they're very enthusiastic and putting a lot of resources behind their solar campaigns. And as you know, they passed their resolution earlier this year to become the greenest city in America. So, I mean, that's a positive stance. And obviously, it's important for those of us that are in the environmental community to keep our eyes on that and see how they're following through and offer our support and encouragement to see that that moves from a statement of being greenest to some sort of reality that we can actually measure.
And I know as in Kansas, BPU is a solar farm too.
Uh-huh.
And it seems like it's municipal utilities that are doing this. Does KCPL, as far as you know, have anything planned for the solar farm?
Yes. One of their they put two items before the PSC. One is their green tariff, mm-hmm. and the second was permission to develop up to 50 megawatts of solar, so their own farms. I think initially they intend to start with smaller solar farms, but what the discussion I heard was, as long as they're going through the application process, let's go for approval for 50 megawatts, and then we can grow into that through the next several years. Initially, the tariff they're selling would be repackaging electricity, wind energy and such that's coming out of the Kansas farms now. So they would be basically entering into contracts to wholesale that and then resell it to our local communities. But they definitely have plans of opening up their own solar.
And are the solar farms more efficient than rooftop solar?
No, I think we're talking a couple different things there. I mean, the big community farms have their places. Mm-hmm. Rooftop solar has potential. I mean, you think of the potential. If we were able to put rooftop solar on every house in the city, we wouldn't need these big solar farms. We would be the solar farm. But I think it's a different buy-in process. It's a different educational process. The community farms that the utilities and the municipalities are pursuing is action they can take independently, they can take right now. To get the level of rooftop solar that could generate the same number of megawatts takes more of a campaign to get a lot of people to buy in. I can put some on my roof that's going to feed my energy and put a little bit back on the grid, but we need to get hundreds, if not thousands, of people to buy into that to really make a substantial contribution to our communities.
And Chris, let me have you get into a little bit about the military aspects and national security of the climate change. In what ways, just give us a broad outline to start with, how climate change affects national security.
Okay. First of all, a little background. I got into studying this back in 1993 when I was on the faculty at the United States Military Academy. I was building a new environmental engineering program. I already had an environmental engineering degree and background. And I was a fairly senior military officer at the time. And I was studying a topic at that time called environmental security. That's the broad range of all kinds of environmental issues that, if the environment changes in a significant way, have an impact on people, which then could become a security issue. I'll give you an example outside of climate change. Water is a scarce resource was the one that was most concerning to me at that time, because you could see many places in the world where people were starting to migrate because of the scarcity of water, the inability to provide for their basic human needs, the inability to grow their own food. Those kinds of issues were starting to create environmental refugees back in the 1990s. I wrote a book in 1999 that talked about the strategic impacts of environmental security. Climate change was in there, but it was one of seven or eight different fundamental environmental changes that have the ability to impact people. Now, over the last 20 years of my study in this, I finally got it down to something this simple as far as I'm concerned. When you deny large groups of people the ability to obtain their basic human needs, water, clean water and sufficient amounts of water, energy, food, basic health, you know, freedom from epidemic disease and those kinds of things. When you change the environment so that those conditions make it impossible for people to obtain their basic human needs, you create an instability in an area, and if that's enough people and in a fragile environment already, it becomes a security issue for those people. And when it's a large enough group of people that are starting to feel the instability to consider migration, to consider the very few options that you have when you're in that condition, that's a national security issue for us. Because national security is not just about winning wars. It's about establishing basic, stable communities around the world. That's the best security that we can have. When people have and can meet their basic human needs all around the world, then we have a much more stable environment and our security is less threatened. That's kind of the concept. Climate change then threatens national security in many ways. Most of us, we think about climate change, the first thing we think about, the Earth's getting a lot warmer, the air is getting a lot warmer. But there are, in my analysis, seven major changes that climate change is making in the world that creates national security threats. Certainly the warming trends is one, but extreme weather, extremes in temperature, extremes in rainfall, as a separate item, the increase in cyclonic action. I had a student that just finished at the Commander and General Staff College, an amazing young man. He had a bachelor's degree in meteorology from Penn State University, but he's an airborne ranger, army officer. He wanted to study how his understanding of meteorology was really going to be an impact to our nation. And he looked just internally and determined the impacts that basically hurricanes coming into the southern part of the United States were going to have over the United States over the next 25 years. And the impacts are going to be extreme for an internal impact to us. So if you look all over the world where you have both hurricanes and other cyclonic action, that's got the ability to displace many, many millions of people. Here in Kansas, the biggest concern is precipitation. Yes, we're warming, but when we get water and how much water we're going to get in the future is a real concern for Kansas farmers. I have spoken to several farmers groups, including the National Farmers Union, and you don't have to tell them that climate's changing. They know it. They know it from trying to do their work and trying to do what they've always done as farmers. They're amazing people as far as I'm concerned. But they wanted to know what are the changes that are going to happen and how are we going to be able to adapt and mitigate to them, because they are certain. And for us here in Kansas, the big issue is water. Yeah. I heard the head of the Kansas Water group for the state of Kansas say their goal right now is to try to extend our aquifer for 20 years, not to save it, to extend its life for another 20 years. And that's before you add in the impacts of climate change. And climate change is not helping. It changes the amount of rain, but sometimes it makes it worse by when it comes. It comes in large amounts over short durations, and then in the periods where you need it for the agriculture and for domestic uses, you have less rain. And that's what we're seeing in this part of the country. To me, from an international standpoint, the scariest thing is the change in the cryosphere. The amount of ice and snow that's stored on the land, that is going to have strategic impacts in many places in the world. When I talk on is it the 8th?
7th. 7th. August 7th.
When I talk on the 7th, I'll use a case study of the Himalayan ice cap, the Himalayan plateau. The amount of snow and ice that they're losing in that is going to change the whole hydrologic cycle of that part of the world. And the reason I use that as an example is because 3.2 billion people rely on that as its source of water. And, by the way, three largest armies in the world that are all nuclear are in that same area, China, Pakistan, and India.
We do need to take a break,
okay.
And when we come back, we will take phone calls, and the number to call in will be 816-931-5534. Again, that's 816-931-5534.
Support for KKFI is provided by The Phoenix and the 9th Annual Phoenix Fest, Saturday, July 28th, starting at noon. On the outside stage, J Love Band, Heather Newman Band, BMW, Brody Buster Band, and Nick Schneblin Band. On the inside stage, Vic G Trio, Wild Women of KC, Tim Whitmer and the KC Express, Tevin Williams, and the Taylor Smith Band. Day passes include full access to all activities, rain or shine. More information and tickets are available at thephoenixkc.com.
All right, this is Richard Mabian, and if you want to join this conversation, come on and give us a call. Don't wait until the last minute to do so. 816-931-5534. 816-931-5534.
Kansas City's number one award-winning, longest-running radio comedy theater program, Shots of the Night, is coming to the KC Fringe. We're a little right of OMG, a little left of WTF, but dead center of LOL. There's five performances of Shots of the Night Comedy Theater at the KC Fringe Festival, opening night Saturday, July 21st at 5 p.m. at Musical Heritage Theater. Additional details and showtimes at kcfringe.org. All proceeds support 90.1 FM, KKFI, Kansas City Community Radio.
When the water rises too high on this current cast. The water level on Lake Ontario can be partially controlled by a dam on the St. Lawrence River, but
only so much water can pass through that at a certain time.
Lana Pollock is the U.S. chair of the International Joint Commission. She says when there's a lot of rain or snow melt, the lake can fill up faster than water can be released down the St. Lawrence River. And if too much water is released too quickly, communities downstream can flood.
There's no place for it to go.
So despite the marvels of modern engineering, the volume of Lake Ontario is so large that there's little that can be done when nature decides to fill the lake to the max. Current Cast is produced in partnership with Cornell University's Atkinson Center for a Sustainable Future. Learn more online at currentcast.org.
All right, welcome back. You are listening to Eco Radio, and my guest today is Bob Grove, the legislative director for the Missouri chapter, and Thomas Hart Benton Group of the Sierra Club, and Chris King, who is retired Brigadier General from the Army, who has a PhD in environmental engineering, and we talk about national security implications of climate change. Chris, I want to follow up because you mentioned 3.2 billion people that rely on one source of water. And one of the things I didn't hear you talk about, and I want to know how you feel it plays into the climate change, is overpopulation and being beyond our carrying capacity. What impact does that have on national security?
I started my discussion talking about environmental security. And what I did for several years was to try to build a model so that we could predict where these incidents of insecurity would be occurring. And what I found was that there were several basic parameters that we need to measure, and we need to see where those overlay from a geographic setting. The independent variable most important in that whole analysis was population growth. We see that there is a degrading environmental security in many places in the world, but it is always in a place that has high population growth rates. So it is, to me, the one biggest concern that we have. The others would be, then, the availability of water, the loss of arable lands, the rate of deforestation. Those are the other environmental changes that create environmental security instability. But population is critical in that.
Okay. And for both of you, when you're thinking about ways and particularly what Sierra Club advocates of solving some of these issues, how do you solve these issues and still can take into account environmental justice issues and the impact that all this has on the poor people in third world countries?
Well, one of the issues that we've dealt with this year and on an ongoing basis for instance, is the placement of the CAFO, the commercial animal farming organizations that tend to often be in more repressed areas of the community, people that don't have the resources, the money, the time to defend themselves. And certainly CAFOs can affect property values, it can affect local health. Those are just ongoing issues that we know we have to deal with. You know, just recently here in Missouri, the animal farming operation, what was the name of that? That's Village? No, that's Valley Oaks over by Powell Gardens. They filed with the DNR a request to expand from a few hundred cattle up to 6,999 cows. Now, that's a funny number, but, you know, if they ask for 7,000 cows, then that changes the oversight. You know, that puts them into a bracket where they would have to take more action to control the pollution and the side effects of the farms. So, you know, let's apply for as many cows as we can without creating the oversight on that. So, unfortunately, the DNR did approve that, but we have filed a administration appeal to the DNR, so that is an ongoing process. You know, General King is talking about water, which is such an important resource throughout the world, and even here. One of the questions that have been raised about this CAFO, you know, expanding to nearly 7,000 head of cattle, the facility now, you know, a few hundred, let's say 300 head of cattle, they're pulling their water from the residential water system, we assume. And they're pulling public records. In January, they used 188,000 gallons of water. So imagine if they're going to go from 300 cows, and to make the math easy, let's say they go up to 6,000 cows. You know, that's a 20-time increase. So you take that 188,000 gallons of water times 20, and what are we up? We're up to 3.6 million gallons of water they're pulling from the residential watering systems. How does our water system support that? You know, the water towers that are in place can't drive that much water. You can imagine the drop of water pressure with that coming out and just the resources to get that water cleaned and into the system. So those are the kind of things that we're trying to examine before, you know, that actually hits the communities and affects those people. You mentioned social justice and stuff. The people that will be affected by that are the poor rural people that can't necessarily take action on their own, and that's where we, the Sierra Club and other groups, want to come in and do what we can to help.
And that much water creates an extreme amount of discharge from those systems too. So you've got polluted water that has to be treated in some way, and in my experience is environmental engineering, heavily concentrated animal waste is some of the hardest to treat. Very, very, very high in carbonaceous or carbon-demanding materials that come out of that. And it's a pollution nightmare unless you do really, really high-intensity treatment. Normally what you do is you build huge ponds and let them settle, but those become a significant problem for communities because they smell. They do things anaerobically. Anaerobics create gases that have it's methane and it smells. Yeah. There are no good winds for trying to treat that much animal waste in a fairly small area.
Absolutely, and that's been a huge issue for us in Missouri this year. Several of the legislative bills that we opposed in Jefferson City had to do with the deregulation and the weakening of the DNR's ability to police this kind of surface waste getting into both our water table and into our rivers. And, you know, we have an ongoing battle in terms of our lobby efforts in Jefferson mm-hmm. City just to raise awareness of what the implications are and to stop legislation, basically deregulation of these industries that will otherwise revert us back to the type of dirty water, dirty air that we may have seen 50 years before the Clean Water and the Clean Air Acts were enacted.
And it's a serious concern what's going on in Washington to change, roll back. Many of the air and water regulations that we've depended on for
the Clean Power Plant, exactly.
The Clean Power Plant, the toxic waste discharges from air pollution, a lot of those are being rolled back right now.
I think the Endangered Species Act, that's under attack now, too.
That's the latest, yes.
Yeah. I want to remind listeners, if you have any questions or comments, you can give us a call, 816-931-5534. Again, that's 816-931-5534.
I wanted to make a comment about eco-justice as far as climate change, but I want to look at the strategic level and the international level. The best data that we have has been generated by the United Nations Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change. They've been working for 30 years to examine the evidence available. That's the evidence that we now have without doubt has demonstrated that climate is changing, and a significant amount of that change is being generated by human activity. But in their reports, they also note that the people highest at risk are those people you were talking about, Craig. It is the people that are in the fragile states. It is the people that are even in the better states that are in the lowest economic condition. Those are the people that live in the margins of that. They live very close to where the rivers flood. They live very close to the ocean, where they're exposed to extreme weather. Climate change is putting those people more and more and more at risk. So all of us will suffer the impacts of climate change, but we have the ability to adapt and mitigate, whereas billions of people do not have that capability and will be much more adversely affected. That's why we in the security community are so concerned about this, because they create catastrophic levels of people unable to sustain themselves. There's an estimate from the Bangladesh Institute for Peace and Security that says by 2050, 35 million people would be displaced from the lowlands in Bangladesh by the problems of sea level rise coming one way and the flooding that comes out of the mountains, because they have extreme runoff in the springs and then it goes dry in the winter. We have 3 million refugees from Syria right now, and we're struggling across the world of what we're going to do with those people. And the environmental migrants that are coming out of Africa. But they're a tenth of what we're talking about when we talk about 35 million Bangladeshis coming. And there are the same number of people in India and the same number of people in Pakistan that live in those lowlands and river valleys. So it is an extreme security problem, and it is an eco-justice problem, because those are the people that will suffer first and most.
With administration, including the EPA, who seem to be disregarding environmental regulation, taking us backwards, what can the security agencies that are concerned about national security, and what can the military or Pentagon do to maybe steer us back and in some way contribute to helping to solve these issues?
They must have some real bad days in Washington right now, some of those folks. I'm going to read you a quote. Secretary of Defense General retired James Mattis, retired Marine, climate change is impacting stabilities in areas of the world where our troops are operating today. That was in his written testimony for his being considered to be the Secretary of Defense in his confirmation hearings. And it went on for about a page and a half, demonstrating where it's both internal problems to the Department of Defense from climate change and the strategic things that I have been talking about. We understand that the military continues to study that. I have students at the Command and General Staff College at Fort Leavenworth that are studying various components of that all the time, both how we can change the way we operate in the military by reducing the amount of fuel and our carbon footprint. I had a Marine do a study. He was a Marine logistician, and it was before the wars were really pulling down. He studied a Marine battalion deployed in Afghanistan. That's about 800 guys. And they were deployed out in different areas of the country. He found that with materials that we already had, new heating and air conditioning systems, new generators, new systems that were already coming into the inventory, he could save 80,000 gallons of fuel a month in one battalion. That's and fuel doesn't cost $2.95 when you're talking about getting it up the Panjshir Valley in Afghanistan. It costs a lot more than that. I don't think anybody even gives us a number of how much it costs by the time you get it there, transport it. But the biggest thing is that was like 30 convoys of troops leaving one place and going up one road to get to where the battalion headquarters and stuff. That's an extreme hazard for those young troops that are traveling. They are targets as they move forward. Those kinds of issues are at the forefront of thinking in the military right now, how we both reduce our carbon footprint, but how we save lives, how we save money, how we make and continue to do the operations we need to. But I don't have a good answer for your question, Craig, how we translate that information over to convincing the civilian side of our government that those are critical issues that we have to address, and we have to address them as a whole of government solution. We can do everything we can possible in the military, but it's a whole of government solution. Climate change has got an extreme challenge for the military, but we're only in support of the rest of the civilian, the Department of Homeland Security, the Department of Energy, and it's got complex economic issues that have to be worked out there. So what we have to do is do our part, be prepared, continue to do our homework, continue to change operations as we can within the Department of Defense, and I think be a strong voice to continue to say, like General Mattis did at his hearing, that this is a big issue. It is a countrywide issue and an international issue, and hopefully over time we'll start to see change in the attitude that the government has going towards how we're going to act to respond to climate change.
I have a more pragmatic answer to your question. You know, obviously the military, and it's wonderful to see the acknowledgement of what's going on and the positions that General King and other people are taking on climate change. But to actually, you know, what can we do about it? What we can do about it is activate at the grassroots level to do the things we're doing with renewables. I mean, to your listeners, become engaged with your local Sierra Club group. You know, here in Kansas City, Missouri, it's the Thomas Hart Benton group that's going to meet our municipal council people that's going with other groups into the state house and actually opposing legislation that hurts our environment. You know, we have groups, the Ready KC campaign that's pursuing renewable energies within our metro area. I would encourage your listeners to go to myteam.readykc.org and become engaged, because, you know, that organization can help you go meet with your personal representatives and express your opinion about the environment and the things you would like to see happen. And then that team can also be called upon to go to Topeka and Jefferson City to get our state-level legislators to pass laws that support our environment instead of tearing them apart. So we engage locally to create change within our local governments, and then we also look at the candidates that we're electing into national office. We've got a primary election coming up on August 7th. Part of our event is that primary watch party, because we want to see environmentally conscious, environmentally progressive candidates elected through the primary so that we can then run them in the general and get them in Washington, D.C. to stop this stuff that's happening. We'll just call this stuff that's happening, you know, to support the EPA and the Clean Power Plan and all of that. So those are the actions we can take. Your listeners, get engaged. Thomas Hart Benton Sierra Club is thbsc.org. You can go to their website. You can join them. Our upcoming event with the general and our silent auction and that, you can find details on that at event.thbsc.org. And we also have the wonderful Kansas group that I can let you talk about.
We do need to take our second break now, and when we come back, we'll still have the phone lines open. So if you have a question or a comment, give us a call at 816-931-5534.
Rights work has nothing to do with freedom of choice. It really is actually appealing to greed.
That's Bill Fletcher on Right to Work. He'll be on the Heartland Labor Forum this Thursday when we look at two initiatives on the August 7th Missouri ballot that are important to working people. Question 1 for Kansas City mandating rental property inspections, and question A for Missouri on the rights of union members. Thursday at 6 p.m., rebroadcast Friday at 5 a.m.
KKFI is volunteer-powered, but relies on financial support from the community. You can share information about your organization or event with our supporters when you become a community marketing partner. Learn more at kkfi.org/marketing.
All right. Thank you for staying with us. This is Eco Radio. And again, my guests are Bob Grove, who is the legislative director with the Missouri chapter Sierra Club and the Thomas Hart Benton Group in Missouri, and Chris King, who is a retired brigadier general with a PhD in environmental engineering. And
I fear that I'll be in trouble if I don't make a minor correction. I'm actually the chair of the legislative committee. You've been calling me director, which I think is wonderful, and I don't really care, but there are other people that probably don't want me to be there. So
right.
I am the legislative chair of the state
committee.
Chapter and local legislative committees.
All right. So again, for those just tuning in, we are taking phone calls, 816-931-5534. Let's talk about a few of the local issues that are a little bit less alarming or easier to talk about. What is Missouri chapter and the groups doing about recycling?
We actually have a program. So August is the program we've been discussing here. We actually have a program in October. Am I saying that right? August, September. I take that back. That's September. So our next program after this one will be recycling. One of the things we're trying to do in THB is to reach out to our urban community and our students and people living in apartments and such. I mean, it's easy to recycle when you got a big yard and such. One of the things we did in just recently, we held a program on indoor recycling. So the ability to compost within a small aerobic environment under your sink, if you will. So that's the type of programming we like to promote. We do an educational program monthly, the first Tuesday of each month, to talk about these environmental issues and helping people learn how to compost within their kitchen. And the September program will discuss the various recycling options. And we'll have speakers talking about the bigger issues of recycling within the Kansas City Municipal, but we'll also be looking at how you can recycle with your own home, you know, the smaller things you can do as individuals that live in apartments or in the dorms at the universities.
Okay, I can kind of guess that some listeners might be thinking, at least I am, how do you do composting inside without having a problem with ants and roaches?
Isn't that amazing? And I was really impressed with our speaker. I'm not going to be able to remember those, but there are actually two techniques they brought in. These are techniques that have come out of Japan. And it's actually a fermentation process. So you're creating a base of fermentation that goes in a little box under your sink, whatever. And then you're just throwing your food waste and such into this box with this fungal culture that is totally capable of tearing this apart. I wish I had these names off the top of my head. If anybody was there and they want to call in and correct, you know, tell me what these are, I'd love to share them. But they really did. I took one of the, we had sample kits. So you mean after the lecture, we actually did a little workshop and built our own and took them home. And I took one home and I've got this box in my kitchen with my food waste and this culture growing in there, dissolving this food and creating wonderful compost, and there's no odor or anything. Who would have guessed?
And going back for a minute on renewables, one of the questions I had is, does Missouri have a production tax credit to help people who get renewable energy?
There's a variety of credits available. I don't know that Missouri specifically, but you know, there's different things available. Unfortunately, some of that stuff's being eclipsed out. I mean, in terms of some of the federal programs on electric vehicles, and you know, KCPL has a credit for upgrading your air conditionings and such. And you know, there's been credits available for solar on your roof. A lot of that stuff's in flux right now. We're really seeing a push back from certain industries that lobby our state houses and such, and are trying to stop the momentum towards solar because they see that threatening their coal and their gas industries and such. So a lot of the initial incentives to get people to buy, they've worked so well that now the lobbyists are in there saying, oh, we have to stop this, or we have to reverse net zero metering, or we have to charge people a usage fee to access the grid. So they're trying to think of ways to make our renewables less efficient. And we just have to push back against that. That's what our lobby teams are doing. My team, .readykc.org, they not only take people to Jefferson City to lobby on the big state issues, but they also meet our legislators in district, locally here in Kent City, Independence, wherever that is, and also in the city, so that when these things do come up, there's a body of people that can stand up and say, no, we want renewables. And that's how we bring about change. We can't expect the Army to come in and do that for us. It's about us standing up and saying, we want renewable energy now. And that voice is very effective. We've had some really great successes this year, and we want to continue with that momentum.
And we talked about some of the upcoming actions, some of the program speakers on coming dates. Do you want to just go through those dates real quick again?
I would love to. Obviously,
tell us where those meetings are held at. And
absolutely. Obviously, our ability to continue to, fight for our environmental rights, rely on people becoming engaged. Our silent auction in August 7th is an important event for us because that's our fundraising to make sure we can continue this legislative activity. I want to give a shout out to all the great supporters who have donated.